This is Terry Gibson, October 8th, 1994. Gnostic Cinema, tape 1 of 4.
Jung Society, Seattle, Fall, October 1994. Gnosticism, Ancient and Modern is the series. This evening, Terry Gibson will be speaking. He's a Jungian analyst and pastoral psychotherapist with Pastoral Therapy Associates in Tacoma. He lectures and writes widely on the integration of psychotherapy and spirituality. Arguably, he says, the three most vivid modern transmitters of this archaic lore are Jungian psychology, Gnostic theology, and contemporary film. There have been revolutionary rediscoveries of this sacred inner myth material at Zurich, Kwaman, Nag Hammadi, and Hollywood. The seminar explores the theoretical interaction and cultural advocacy of the Jungian and Gnostic thought for the fragile presence of the psyche, so long hidden in our overly crowded and noisy midsts. The medium for this reflective journey will be contemporary film, which is richly porous with this archetypal Gnostic lore.
I've been exploring for 3 or 4 millennia now inside Western cultural experience. And I think hopefully these cinema events that I'm going to be showing over the weekend will kind of bring that alive in a powerful way. But just to begin, well, actually, let's kind of show you what I'm hoping to accomplish in terms of an agenda. Incidentally, please move yourself around any way you need. In fact, I know already you're going to have trouble seeing unless I get this out of the line of fire. But position yourself any way that you need to tonight to see the overheads. But what I'm hoping to do is, we're talking about Gnostic cinema, Jungian exploration of film and culture. Friday, kind of an overview of the experience and the model. Tomorrow, I want to talk a little bit about, all day, about what I call the Gnostic Odyssey. And we'll start talking, first of all, the Gnostic image of the fall or the descent and dismemberment, and talk about that as an alchemical process. And there'll be a lot of cinema that I use tonight to kind of set an overall frame and set a tone. And then tomorrow morning, we'll be looking at cinema images about falling. In the afternoon, I want to talk about the other side of the Gnostic Odyssey, is the return, the ascent to the light of the Pleroma, back to the one or the wholeness. It's going to be real clear, this is an enormous literature. There's everything from bizarre kooks and kinks on one end to rigid dualists on the others. But I do think, historically, there has always been a pure non-dualist tradition in the West that's been trying to work with this split between mind and body in a way that has integrity all through Western experience. And it's that dualistic experience that I'm interested in, and I think Jungian psychology responds as an analytic experience to help us re-experience the unity that's under the apparent diversity of the world that we're in. And just a couple of, I'd like to put Jung quotes up. Jung once addressed a convention. It's an anecdotal report, but the anecdotal report is that he began the lecture by saying, "My fellow Gnostics." He was pretty disclosed in private about this. Jung was pretty cagey in public when they tried to corner him about issues of mystical belief and his own personal theology. But one of the letters, "Let the light that I have carried in my womb shine forth," sounds like a very Gnostic image to me. And just kind of let that resonate for a minute. And the assumption is that I think we all have light in our wombs, that we are all part of the splinters of divinity that have fallen into a world that's often pretty crass and pretty overwhelming. I think this, the news makes me, I need to let you know that I'm not at all connected with the French Quebec guy that in Switzerland like that stuff. We may be trying to renovate a Masonic lodge, but I wouldn't. All my friends now are worried about whether I've been making trips to Toronto or Quebec, and it has nothing to do with that. It actually is quite nice. My spouse and I just were riding bikes one day and saw this building and fell in love with it, and we've been after it for 5 years. And so when I said, I could never get through to these people, so in kind of a Gnostic way, I just looked in a phone book and kept calling for a year. I'm kind of persistent. Nobody answered. And then about a year ago, somebody answered, and they said, "We just had a meeting. This thing's never been on sale. How did you know that we decided this meeting to sell it?" It's one of those kind of, and the buildings are kind of in our lives that way. And both our parents, our fathers, were 32nd degree Masons. The Masonic tradition is both, has the worst of American culture and the best of mystical culture all kind of combined into one. And it's kind of interesting to us that we're going to be living in a Masonic lodge. And my experience is the Masons, there's usually, if you start talking stuff, you'll find that 20-25% of them will get you over to the side if they hear you talk. And the other 75%, I think, kind of did this a fellowship. But you get 20-25% that are aware of the legacy and the lore that's locked in that tradition, the lore of this kind of Gnostic, mystical. So my spouse and I, we don't know what they're going to take out, whether we're going to watch CNN sitting on, I'll sit on the East Temple seat one night, she'll sit on the North, and we don't quite know how it's going to work out. But. God is reality itself. It's another thing to think about. It's another Jungian phrase. God is reality itself. And kind of a guiding image for us all weekend in the Gnostic Gospel of Philip. Truth did not come into the world naked, but it came in the types and images. And I want to suggest to you that film is not naked. It's bathed in divine imagery. And I want to suggest, I have a theme that every kind of film, from the most crass apparent pornography to the most bizarre grade B beach party bingo, are films that are yearning for the restoration of lost wholeness and the restoration of lost innocence. That is a consistent theme across all narrative fictional film. And it's really interesting to me, we'll talk more about this, but we're celebrating, we have in this last decade, the 100th birthday of the birth of depth psychotherapy. And it's also, as psychotherapy was being formed in Central Europe, film was being created in Central Europe, the Lumière brothers in Paris and others. It's very interesting to me that the two traditions have been playing back and forth in the dark with images of light and dark and trying to come up with some kind of truth about why we're here and what's the human experience and odyssey on this planet. And then just one quote, and then I just want to show a little piece to get us in a kind of a Gnostic mood. But I thought it'd be nice to have a filmmaker share his passion about the art form. As we know, in major narrative film, unfortunately, the vast majority still, even 20 years after feminism in this country, 90-95% of the main narrative directors are males. So it's still a very male, gender-biased kind of medium. But there's a lot of really talented women that are coming online. But I want to just kind of read this passage. Jonas Meek is talking a little bit about what filmmaking means to him. Our movies are like extensions of our own pulse, of our heartbeat, of our eyes, our fingertips. They are so personal, so unambiguous in their movement, in their use of light, their imagery. There is pain in the arts of the last few decades. I just want to stress that. There is pain in the arts of the last few decades. The whole period of so-called modern art is nothing but the pain of our ending civilization, the last decades of the Christian era. Now we are looking, we are being pulled by a desire for something joyful deep within us, deep in the stress, and we want to bring it down to earth so that it will change our cities, our faces, our movements, our voices, our souls. We want an art of light. Really nice Gnostic quote from Jonas Mekas. And of course, he's an avant-garde filmmaker, but I really believe that's the impulse. And what's really fascinating to me about film, it's such a complex medium, although I'm more and more impressed with the power of the kind of auteur theory, that the director may have the greatest single impact on pulling the units of film together. But it's really clear that film is a community, it's genuine communitas. It escapes even the desires of the creators, the scriptwriters and the directors and the producers. Film has a life of its own. You talk to people who produced film, and the unexpected twists and turns of film that work. So sometime, there was a film that I thought was fairly disappointing. It had a kind of interesting premise, but The Four Weddings and a Funeral. But I would have loved to have been in the rush room. I think it got trivial at times, but I would have loved to have been in the rush room when they look at the daily rushes, and they did the funeral scene, and they read the Auden poem. And this secondary character that was kind of blended into the script, suddenly we had so much passion. It's one of the most powerful grief experiences I've ever seen portrayed on film. And I have a feeling it was a surprise. They had no idea it was going to work as well as it did until they got the daily rushes back. It's extraordinary. I don't have that as one of the film quotes I'm going to use, but I do have the Auden poem. And it's just exceptional. It's exceptional. So film is a community art form. And I think the soul gets in there despite all of the greed and watching market shares and the distributors and doing market surveys about how you end films and start them, and they're tinkering with them till the day of release almost. It escapes their control and belongs to psyche, even with all these kind of the splinters of light gathered in this film still come through. Yes. Well, I want to be pretty broad. I think any kind of moving image that we're looking at, television. I mean, I'm really interested in moving images that, and of course, they really. It's it's a paradox. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. What we see in film is a product of a whole bunch of community and economic and forces.
So it's kind of like a focal lens.
Yeah.
I can imagine myself which would be the lens through which things are created or seen is the film.
Yeah. The film is us. We join. I mean, Woody Allen's kind of played in a nice way with that theme, but the film is us. But you know, it's even the paradox. I say moving images, but really it's a series of still images that are quickly fanned in front of our eyes. And we'll talk more about this, but I've gone to some of the initiation caves in Central Europe and early France, and when you go into those places, you go into Altamira, or you go in some of the caves in the Lascaux district, and you see these wonderful images on the wall, and if they'll turn the lights out, and then they use flashlights now, they use torches in the old days, these static images that are painted on the walls begin to move, these ancient bison herds and stuff. They were cinema houses 20,000 years ago. We've had, it's really amazing to me in the age of video, that we'll still pay $5, $6, $7 to go into an uncomfortable, drafty, barny room with a bunch of smelly strangers with sticky stuff on the floor
But there's something about that experience of crawling into kind of a cave-like experience and having something bigger than life above us. And good film if it works. It's an extraordinary art form when you think about it. It has to get us to suspend belief within the first 30 seconds that it's going to work. To absorb, and it invariably works that way. Even cruddy films usually have a capacity to get us to suspend belief. We awaken every once in a while, but it's an extraordinary art form. But the set of mood, this is even kind of mystical. I have to disappear behind the screen here. We didn't have enough room to put tables here, so as I go and get the films, I will disappear like in a Greek Orthodox service. And I go into the Holy of Holies here to pull some stuff out. But just a set of mood, we're gonna actually see the beginning of a film that's only a decade old, and obviously it confused and bothered audiences that I think overtly dealt with these themes. I think the director clearly had a sense about it. And just position yourselves, we've got two screens. It's The Rapture. And all I want you to do is just watch the magic of how this director has to set a mood and gets us into a Gnostic terrain very quickly. This is my first time working with it, so hopefully I'll be able to get this all figured out and we'll go. What's your honest body experience?
Tense,
yeah.
He used the music to create an image that wasn't true, particularly at the beginning.
What was the image that wasn't true?
The music would have portrayed something sinister about to happen, at least to me. The camera just moved into a group of people working.
Yeah, yeah. So music, there's a sense of sinister, body tightness. Any of these kind of body experiences?
Something being split, kind of routine, mundane, all the operators doing the same thing, and then you go to this incredibly erotic.
Yeah. Now, kind of split. I mean, there's a split between the mundane and the erotic. Yeah, there is that. Although even the erotic, I think my body experiences is fairly mundane. When you look at it, at some levels, it's a really mundane eroticism. Flat. Any other kind of body experience? It's how they got the same Foley editor did the soundtrack of the film upstairs right now, working, kind of creating mood in here. Any other just body experiences? Or what words, well, let's kind of move then into kind of thematic stuff. What kind of single one or two word phrases would you use to describe your experience of what you just saw? Kind of emotional words, descriptive words.
Isolation.
Good word. What's that? Coldness, isolation.
Desperation.
Hunger. A lot of dissociation, isn't there, between voices on the phone and between bodies that are supposed to be together, alienation, coldness, dissociation, hunger. Any other kind of one-word phrases that you'd have to describe? These are very good words. It seems to be the opposite of alienation here. In what way? Well, except I think the director believed, my sense as I looked at that piece of film, the director believed that was alienated sex. That was not related sex. That was lonely and cold and tense and dissociated sexuality. That was not relational sexuality at all. It enhanced their loneliness and despair. It didn't relieve it.
That soft, tender part of him that needed to touch.
There was no soul in the encounter. In fact, I've got a little chart, but I'll just tell you, a thing I'd encourage you to think about is Jungians. I think every film in the first 30 seconds You can look for where is the ego, the kind of conscious functioning part of ourself, and the film will give you a diagnosis of what ego's problems in living are. There's usually a central narrator in any kind of film setting. And you get fairly quickly an image of what ego's dilemmas are in living. You get some image, and I'll put a chart up later, but I have kind of a pyramid chart. Some of you have been here, some of my workshops before, seen there's a kind of pyramid chart. The self's down at the bottom, and Jungians like to talk about ego self-axis, getting the ego in some kind of connection with the self. There's some kind of hint about where the self or the soul or divinity is, and ego's difficulty in getting related to that. And there's some statement about the problem of that interference. Where would ego be in this little vignette? Who kind of carries the persona or the voice of the film so far? Yeah, the woman. She really carries voice for us. And her voice, I think, is full of a lot of despair and alienation and coldness, all the kind of words we've heard, dissociation. Where is the self? Kind of tough one in this film. Where is the self? It's kind of tough to locate. You might even have to be pretty intuitive to think where it might even be hidden. I think it's a hidden self here. But where's the self here? Well, the camera, in what way? That's interesting. That's interesting. In what way? And we all are being the camera. Every film, it's kind of an interesting experience. It is voyeurism. We're voyeurs into the privacy of the soul. Every film, there's this kind of safe thing. We're out in the dark and nobody can see us and we can see everything. Kind of in a funny way, it's a kind of a funny dissociation we do every time we go to a film. But how is the camera the self here? It's a very interesting concept. I'm very interested to know how you pursue that.
Well, I think that the viewer relates to the person in the box, and the person in the box comes out of the box and does something different. It's kind of like, it depends if you're self-centered or not. That's my answer to the question.
Yeah. Well, and of course, clearly the camera is us, and it's Tolkien, the director, and it's the script writers. And I think every film has a soulful intent. I do the camera is attempting to do in what Jungian, that's a very interesting one, I'm just composing this with you right now, but the camera in the film medium is really trying to do what Jung calls individuation. It's really trying to get the soul resident or connection to get ego connected to the soul. That's what film is always about. It's always about individuation, no matter how much it gets cheapened potentially by the financing and the kind of hype of film. That's really one of the camera and all of us around it are trying to make soul. We're trying to experience some kind of experience, trying to encounter individuation. So I do think I think the film itself, that you get a sense that this director is feeling all of this and holding it with us. And the script writer, and he's a writer and director both. He's holding this with us. He's feeling the pain of this. And he's encouraging us to have empathy. As a lot of audiences did not like this film. For reasons you can probably see, it all that kind of coldness, and I think it got too close to home, too quick. I mean, people said, God, I just left the office. So I don't keep seeing images of the office up on the screen. And my own sense of alienation, sensual in every other way. So I think the camera. Any other place that you, the self or the soul or the deep spiritual motive, so the light might be? In the hunger. And where did we get phrases in the script or in images of hunger here? Because this come out. Where did you get senses of hunger?
When you're driving around, after
dropping off,
you're driving around.
And where are they? Did you notice what's the contrast of the two environments? We open an environment, daytime, mechanical, compartmentalized, routinized. Degrading kind of environments that most... I mean, you go in any major office building and those kind of degrading environments exist. Our culture is porous with them. Supposedly in the light, and it's too much in the light. It's just soulless and dead. And then when they're out, what time of day is it? It's at night. We're not in Apollo's land anymore. We're out in Dionysius' land. But Dionysius ain't been found yet. They're looking for him. Him, her. I mean, and Dionysius in his androgynous form, they're looking for the kind of wild god, the Bacchian god of the night. Nose job and a rug. You know, then they go down... Do we want? We'll find Dionysius at the airport tonight, or will we find him at the Colonial Club? You know, will we find her there. Or here? I mean, hunger, and I think it's to go meet Dionysius. They really want to have. And what's Dionysian language that they use here? It occurs several times. You remember Dionysian language? Let's have fun. It's kind of flat and kind of kinky, but underneath it, you get a hint of the soul in it. They really want fun. They want what the Greeks would call eros, and we'll probably talk more about that tonight. They want a genuine eros. They wanted the kind of fun and joy that Jonas Mekas talks about in An Age of Pain that lives resident to the deep self, a deep embodied sense of fun. but they can only work, they can only shill it on the surface. But that's really, you get a sense, they're really hungry for that. They don't even have the beginning idea about it. Even our culture doesn't train us in having house skills to find Dionysius. There ought to be courses in high school, how to go out at night and find Dionysius, and we don't have them. We got courses now on how to have safe sex, but no courses about Dionysius. And of course, the fact that you saw the survey today, apparently we are much more traditional sexually than we ever imagined. They had this new survey, and Americans are, we're much more monogamous than we are. But it, I don't believe there's more eros in that kind of, this looks like Puritanism boiled over again. We may have been kind of frightened, but there's no more, sex is as alienated with somebody known 40 or 50 years most of the time. People I see in marital therapy is these people here. There's no more, they don't find Dionysius any easier than these people do. Our culture is lost about where to go find Dionysius. So yes, it's language, let's go have any other phrases in the script? Particularly towards the end that you heard? Yeah, and he said, can you handle being taken to the limits? That's all Dionysius talk. Can you handle if you get flooded by something you can't control? Ego's got to give up. Well, that's kind of hope that only if something frightening happened, that's kind of the kicks. But deeper than that, I think there's a hope that Dionysius might be surprised with meaning. They might be surprised with depth. And you know, I think, well, was that far enough for you? Did we get out there far enough? It hurt kind of, it was really kind of almost a Greta Garbo thing. Well, that was interesting. Wanting it and yet it got us, but still there's that thing, we want to get out of control and yet they're real macho. They're all macho. They're kind of patriotic, we're going to be in control. Oh, yeah, yeah. And a chaos that they really don't want. It's a funny paradox. They say they want it, and yet you know they're fighting it at all levels of their being. They really don't.
What do you mean when they say, let's have fun, let's
see
how much we can control?
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Do you believe that the self has judgment, or is it non-judgment?
That the self has judgment?
Is it a judgmental or a non-judgmental?
Well, Mike, I mean, it's interesting. Clinically, my experience is that the self, when it shows up in our lives and it shows up in our death experience, carries both judgment and grace. And it always carries mercy. I mean, that's just an answer off the top of mind. That's been my experience. And you know, there's a big split in the Jungian world between the traditional Jungians who say, Jung seemed to have this kind of notion that we live in a pretty fallen, and evil has to be taken very seriously. But you always get the sense in Jung that if, as painful as it is, that it does lead to, if you can weather and suffer through the suffering, it leads to a merciful place. It leads to a place that has more light. Has more mercy, has more, whatever those words mean. And there's, of course, another school of Jungian thought now that says that that's kind of naive and traditional, maybe even patriarchal, that, you know, every day and everywhere getting better and better, even through Jungian analysis, you know, and kind of lead further. But I do, but that's been my experience, is the self always comes, never with more judgment than people can handle. Oh, we're going to see some vignettes out of The Last Temptation of Christ, which is another Gnostic essay. I think of Scorsese, the reason people got so intense about both Kantzakis' original novel, and he got exiled from his homeland, because of his perceptions. And the reason the film got people so stirred up, even, you know, Scorsese put this thing, this kind of novella or fictional experience at the beginning. Well, we all know it's not. It's really about the spiritual crisis in our culture, the Gnostic crisis. And that whole thing there is, that whole film's about, it's a fantasy about Christ's individuation process and the rhythms between the judgment and the grace of the self and the mercy and condemnation of the self. It's a whole essay on that. If you look at it at that level, you know, Constance, I think with that visceral, he starts... He values it so much, we won't see this, but Scorsese starts with that wonderful passage out of Constantine. I've always been, the great struggle in the West of dualism between body and spirit is where I've always lived, right in the maw of that struggle. And this is going to be an essay about that. That's a very Gnostic kind of image. But I think it's a Gnostic about how that struggle mediates the self, and you asked a good question. And in my experience, and I think Scorsese would agree, and I think Tolkien would agree here, is the self always comes with judgment and grace, but never more judgment and never more grace than we can handle. That's the mercy. That's the merciful part of it. But any other ideas about where the self may be, where the vessel of judgment and grace and mercy, if we're using that language, might be here? Who is the vessel that may carry that? Any intuitions about it? Of those four characters, who might be the Messiah, the one that carries the self in this? We all are messiahs in our lives. You know, if you think about that in images, we all do mediate to our families and our community at varying times this judgment and mercy from deep places.
Yeah, she said he likes to watch.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So one clue might be he.
Plus he took a lot of persuading, or some persuading from her, to even go into that experience again. I got the sense that he's getting older and he's
Incidentally, I'll bet you he... I think he's an easy character, so I think most of us, if we were in that room, we'll go sit over with him, you know, because we already are voyeurs. I'm fascinated with watching other people go for the limits, and maybe Dionysius will show up, but if he does and he's out of control, I know where the door is. I know where the exit is, you know, whatever that kind of stuff. So some people think it's the partner in the ninth. Anybody else? Vic. Who else? Brandy. Interesting thing. They all do carry. He's an interesting character. He does carry some of that. Both of them do. But they disappear as the text narrative goes on. They're lost along the way. The woman is... It is our narrator. I invite you to see the whole thing. We probably won't get sensitive. But I want to suggest that this is a story about a female Job in our culture who stands up and defies God and demands more of God than God even thought she was capable of. It's a film about a modern contemporary Job who talks past, you know, one of the great Gnostic myths, we'll talk tomorrow, but we have fallen into this world of depravity, this world here. It is called Rapture, and it's Michael Tolkien, you saw that, and it's available in video stores, and it's really nice. But it's really a film about a contemporary Job. I won't give it all away, but you kind of look at it, see if it matches for you. But this is a film about the depravity and lostness. And the story is that, you know, one of the Gnostic myths is that the Sophia fell out, the feminine fell out, that she cared about matter, cared about the loss, got down here and gave birth to creatures who were partial gods, but they weren't complete gods, and they only had part of the truth, and they got inflated with their part, the Yaldabaoth. So these middle, kind of middle management in the divine hierarchy, if you will. middle management run amok and gone bad, called Demiurgs. And they wanted to convince us that they are the real gods. And in fact, they are jealous of us because Sophia, in trying to undo the harm, tricked them. They created man and woman in divine image. They tricked them. She came in and breathed. She carried the divine essence of the one God. We'll see some images of this. And our whole struggle then is to get past the demigurgs back to the one again. And I think this whole film is about being caught in the middle level of spiritual management and the kind of incredible individuating courage it takes in a lost culture to stand alone and to be responsible for the ego you carry. She destroys her own innocence in this film. It's a very moving thing. She destroys that most precious to her and takes responsibility for it and gets courage in the act and is able to demand more of God than God probably thought she could provide this person. It's a very interesting film. It's a modern Job's. Yeah, well, yeah. And I think again, it was, those are uncomfortable themes for modern audiences. Very uncomfortable themes. Well, it's really interesting. You are using erotic in the way it's gotten flattened in this culture. It's not the original Greek sense. And since we're talking about eros, maybe let's look at some... Because part of the solution... let's put a model up quickly, and then let's think about the solution. So much stuff I'm not going to get to tonight. But one of the things while we're thinking about film, this is a nice quote, too, coming out of depth. This is from a guy named Eberwein about film. But just, we've been having a collective dream together. Many people have noticed that watching a film is like having a dream. Narrative elements sometimes seem to be outside spatial and temporal laws. Get out of people's way here. The viewing conditions in the theater, such as the darkened room and the relative sense of isolation, are reminiscent of our solitary existence as dreamers alone in the night. You really get that feeling. The overpowering images on the screen sometimes frighten and make us feel the same kind of paralysis we know in nightmares. And we got some of that was drawn up already. You could feel it tightening. Some of you are feeling it tightening the body. We're being drawn into a film. If you thought this was going to be a Friday night, my wife and I have a golden rule to only go to films on Friday night after a work week that had got sex and violence in them. We don't want to do any work. We just want vicarious, cathartic violence and sex. But sometimes you get tricked. This was the one we went on Friday night. This ain't no Friday night. This is no Friday night film. It's a nightmare film. And, you know, you get in and you say, my God, I've been here all week. I wanted to get away from this, you know, and here we are. But it's a nightmare. In addition, film seems real the way dreams do. In fact, their ability to make us believe we are part of the action is for many one of film's most important achievements as a form of art. And I just again want to look at the way the film and depth worlds have crossed. It's a visual dream. It operates like dream, and it gets us to suspend our belief like dream. Well, it's a smaller screen, and I don't think it has the same impact. I think it can be legitimate studying, but I think video and people's fascination with that is I think people even got nervous about it. Got too much voyeur, too much of the stuff gets operating in a room with strangers with images that are too overpowering. It's a way to control a medium and put it in a small box and maybe manage it in our homes. It's a way to reduce down this power. But people know that it's a trick, and even though they don't like it, it's disgusting. We're selling more film tickets than ever in the history of the media. People are still going out, and they're junking up on videos, but they still got to go on the weekend. Oh, absolutely. Well, the culture's porous with them. But we're talking about, you know... I'll run down these things, but we're talking about Eros. Yes?
You keep saying suspend belief. You think what you mean is suspend disbelief?
Yes. Our disbelief that this is happening, but to suspend the belief structures that this is a fake. It's a nice way to put it, our disbelief. Eros. Show you the difference between rich erotic and true erotic. Some of you, Robert Sardello's done a lot of writing, kind of the Hillmanian school, but this is what he says about our culture, and I think what film tries to address in all art forms. Medicine, education, money, food, energy, media, technology, religion, buildings, economics, and I can even say art in a lot of places, unfortunately. All of those organizing forms that together ought to make culture no longer do so, but instead are making a pathological civilization. The new symptoms are fragmentation, specialization, expertise, depression, inflation, cruelty, hardness, violence, and absence of beauty. Our buildings are anorectic, our business paranoid, detached, and abstract, our technology manic. These symptoms indicate the loss of the containment characteristic of the vessel of soul. We need a reevaluation of the domains of the modern world in terms of metaphor, image, story, and dream, and I would add art here. But it's a statement about how we flattened Eros. Our buildings have no Eros anymore. Our religion has no Eros. Our relationships have no... This whole film was an essay about disappearing and flattened Eros. And so we go to these theaters. People are kind of asking questions, so maybe I ought to share a little bit of some of the fundamentals I have about film from a Jungian perspective. And then we'll see some images that try to put Eros back into our experience. Some of you have been with me before. This is a rerun, but these are important backgrounds. Film is the most readily available vehicle for either escape or genuine therapeutic healing in our culture. The cinema is the most widely attended cathedral in our era. That's why people are still buying tickets in mass numbers, even with the video market, because they have a spiritual experience. They may not even label it that way, but they have an experience. And it's like a dream. Most people repress it right away. Film is like dreams. If you can keep it in consciousness, keep it needling you. Keep the body. That's why you'll always hear me all during the weekend. I'll ask you about your body experience first. That's where powerful things go, and we store them, and that's where we also repress them. But a good dream or a good film, if you want to keep it and let it individuate your own dialogue with your ego, dialoguing with deep self issues, you got to hold it in consciousness. Otherwise, the Eros drains away, and it's forgotten by the time you get home. And most people junk up on it. It's like dreams keep us from going crazy. I mean, you've all read the dream research. You know, researchers have cut out REM sleep, and now they've even identified non-REM dreaming. We now know people dream in non-REM states, but they'll cut that part of sleep out, and within 4 to 5 days, people reproduce all the active symptoms of schizophrenia. At a physiological level, it keeps us sane. And I think a lot of people go to art, and it's working at some deep level as a way to cathartically discharge in the darkness. The most powerful, you know, I see lots of examples, but I went to Gettysburg. You know, it was originally designed for TV. The Turner outfit wanted to do an actual, authentic reenactment of the Gettysburg Battle. The National Park Service let them film for the first time in its history on the side of Pickett's charge in those three days. It's a long thing. It was originally 12 units on TV, so it ran for like 3.5 hours. They put it into commercial film before they released it on TV. And those of you who know, the third day was this famous Pickett's charge, where some of you may, or the historians may know, it's incredible. It was the South really lost the battle. They sent like 30 or 40,000 troops, the flower of the Southern South, the young South, that whole generation. And a heroic thing across this field into overwhelming fuselages from cannons and an entrenched Union force. And these men in close order drill, they went out and only like 25% of that army returned after a three-hour engagement. The whole flower of the South was lost in this mile-long field. And they kept closing ranks and kept going towards the angle to get... And I started noticing not women, but men starting to sob in the audience and embarrassed about it. And I said, why is this impacting me so much? And my dad, I have a lot of dad arrows because my dad was, the only way he could relate to me in erotic ways was to, we went to Civil War battlefields together and trips alone with minesweepers digging up cannonballs and stuff. So I had a lot of lost father stuff there for me. But you know, it suddenly dawned on me, that's what happens to these men day after day in a patriarchal world in these corporations, that they're told to go across this field, and when men fall on either side of them, close the ranks and keep marching for the wall and be a man. And psychologically, and all that lost eros, their father told them to do that, and their grandfather, their ancestors are all on their back and saying, carry the sorrow of that alone, and there is no grace in this world for you or mercy. There's only duty. And do it with as much courage as you can, and don't act afraid. And hope you when you die with honor and you're not a coward. And I think men in that room, and I doubt very many men wanted to hold that after leaving the theater. It was an epiphany of affect that happened. And it was mediated, and it was a spiritual experience in the cathedral of image. But it'll only work if they can take it home with them and let it continue to eat at them like a good dream or something. You continue to journal and work it. Film is the fundamental communicator, educator, and translator of living myth in our culture. There's no other art form as powerful to mediate living image as film. All the elements of myth that are alive and psychoactive in our culture are in film. The Fisher King worked because the active ingredients of the Grail myth are right there, and it moves us. Some films are not that overt, but it's in all these films. Film is deeply sacramental, and like the sacraments, is enhanced and deepened by an attitude of conscious, soulful reception. That's what I'm talking about. Film, like analysis, works through individuation by conscious, alchemical, symbolic interaction with the archetypal world of the psyche, facilitates often rapid regression to early life damage, and suggests repair opportunities. I want to suggest that's why these men were crying. They were regressed to their own damaged childlike innocence in a room when they started weeping at the Gettysburg thing. It was a rapid regression outside their control. When we're deeply moved in film, archaic, ancient parts of our own woundedness get activated in film. Film is a crucial medium of initiatory ritual and transformative experience, one of the few fully viable precincts or temenoses left to us to give us information about how to become men and women in this culture and how we've been damaged in our initiation. The trouble with film is that it just remains film. It would be really nice if after a lot of film things, all the women went to a moon lodge together and all the men went to a sweat lodge to process what the images presented to them. I think modern film is as important and activates as much to us as the ancient shrine, like Aloysius. Probably if we got a little, you know, they now know that they spike the wine there with a little LSD derivative, a natural derivative. We spike the Coke and the popcorn with a little, kind of get us a little bit more psychoactive and more opened up. And it went, you know, there in the ancient world, they went in and they saw a sacred drama, Aloysius, the sacred drama of the Demeter and Persephone story, because it's mythically alive. And they prepared for it for a year, and then they processed the experience afterwards. And the ancients, you know, menopausal woman met you at those postmenopausal woman met you at those gates and said, anybody that goes in here and rats about what they experience is going to die, a fie on your household. And not one human being, we have not found one person that's told us exactly what happened there. Even Christians who later were quite irritated with the pagan worldview, Origen, Tertullian, some people who had actually known the mysteries, have not told us. And they all reported great experiences of what they call great consolation and transformative grief. One of the most powerful moments in their life when the sacred drama was presented to them. Well, film is our modern sacred drama, but we don't have an initiatory lodge that prepares us to go in. And we don't have organized initiatory communities that receive us on the outside. What I want to suggest is that maybe Jungian psychology may be one community that can kind of receive these images and try to keep them amplifying and working at a kind of deeper level. That's amazing that not one person reported or ratted on those experiences. The initiatory power of going to a precinct and having a sacred drama. So we have part of the ritual left, and that film, I think, celebrates that. Film is living soul experience and therefore needs to be read. And that's what I'm hoping we're going to be doing the next couple of days, is learning to kind of get literate at a psycho-spiritual level about film content. To be read gnostically, alchemically, mythically, and mystically requires profound devotional literacy in these areas. that hopefully you get excited enough. There are great books out there. You're going to see a lot of stuff out of June Singer's book. I think June has done a great job in that little Gnostic Book of the Hours to make Gnostic stuff accessible to our culture. It came out at a great time. It was like a year ago. It came out in December. And I doubt it was in too many Judeo-Christian stockings yet. It's still too unapproachable. But it was designed to come out in the middle of that kind of Christian and Hanukkah marketplace where people could start letting these ideas get close to them. Film is the key holder of paradox and the opposites. I mean, it's moving image. You know, it's a bunch of stills put together. All outer world film, no matter how grade B or trivial, has inner significance. And all inner world film, no matter how self-absorbed, has outer world implications. And film, most of all, is the respectful teller of story and lover of mystery. Film is not a representation of the transcendent function. John Beebe says that it's a representative of the transcendent function. You know, in Jungian psychology, Jung says that we've got this great ego-self organism, this axis, and the ego wants to get close to the soul. And that the ego has to thread the great energy of that individuating process is the opposites, the tension between good and evil, light and dark, the dualism, male and female. And if we can hold that and not split, people said, I feel a little split during the film. If we can hold it and not split, we can find the unus mundus, the one, the divine one, that's at the core of our being. That's kind of the hope. But and what does that in Jungian theory is this transcendent function comes over the horizon. If we can bear the tension enough, there's this organizing, mediating set of symbols that often comes of what Jung called the unus munus, the one world, or the una mystica, the one mystical whole that holds us all together. If we can just bear the tension long enough and not be reactive or get rancorous, but just hold it, that it will come to us. That's the transcendent function. Well, he says it's a representative of it, but I say it's really a vehicle for individuation, that it is a vehicle for the transcendent function itself. It lives. It's not just a representative. We experience the transcendent function in some film. For spiritual direction, for creating, getting ego to recognize the transcendent function and the visions of the self it relays and portrays. So that's what I really believe about film. And hopefully we'll be developing some kind of spiritual literacy as we go along. Close to a break. Let's put one image up and it'll take us into a break, and we'll take a 5 to 10 minute break.
Here's the self down here, and here's this ego self axis. You've all seen this. Is the Jungian unconscious, this is the Freudian unconscious, but here it is up here. Eros, the transcendent function, is what relates us, heals all these tensions so that the self can be mediated. The juice of this process, the living juice that makes it possible, is Eros. Genuine erotic encounter when the opposites get together and have a conjunction, where the male and female, the good and the bad, the light and the dark, the heaven and the earth get together, we have a sense of wholeness suddenly. We're touched by it. Now, I'll just give you, I stated what I think is all our goal. I'm going to show you an erotic image, and then we'll take a break. Genuinely erotic. Not this voyeuristic erotic stuff, but genuinely. It was a great film that came out a year ago, just got out on video. Like Water for Chocolate. We're going to see that original image where her grief becomes an erotic experience for the community. Disappear back in the inner sanctum. I'll get the clip and I'll set it up for you. Now, the theme here, just to kind of set you up, Tita, youngest daughter. This is one of the kind of the Hispanic surrealism, and it's, you know, the kind of Hispanic whole culture of surrealistic literature is coming out of it. It's a wonderfully surreal film about a border family. And again, I think it's really interesting. It's border. Norte Americanos, above the border, below the border, Hispanic and American, you know, unconscious, conscious, we're on the border. I mean, even the film is at the twilight lines. We're pushing those limits. They were pushing in the rapture. And it's a family, a traditional Hispanic family, and the father, as you learn, as the film goes on, you learn that the mother had a rich but disappointing erotic experience with the father who failed her. And she has these daughters, invariably neurotic. It's a richly neurotic family, like all of ours. It's got a lot of good neurosis, and it's showing it's out of control, just like all our families. The youngest daughter, though, had fallen in love with a young lad in town, and the mother says, in our tradition, you're going to stay with me till I die. Your life and soul is my soul. And she married. She's going to wed this young man off to another daughter. Kind of a self-congratulatory daughter that's kind of unconscious, not really connected. And Tita, we're going to see a scene now. Tita's filled with grief about this. And there is a cook in the kitchen, a family cook. And she's a mediatrix for
if you're looking for where the self is, she mediates the self. And we're going to see her coming up to the bedroom to offer her condolences and to offer food, soul food, to this woman who's going into the night with this grief that she will not be able to marry her beloved. And is there anything erotic that can be done with great grief? Well, we'll find out. So I turn on light enough so I can see how to even eject the old one out of here. See if I can... Ah, there it is. Well, notice your body experience. Where is this little vignette resonating in your body? These images get in under the... Yeah, there's an opening. Yes, yes. Yeah, you know, our body felt like hard clay in the rapture. You kind of tighten it more and more. You don't want to be permeated by the images. Here, this film opens. It's a nice image. It like turns us into loam. We want to soak it up into deeper levels. There's something profound going on, and we don't resist the images here. There's a different effect. What other kinds of things is your body doing? Heat, yes, yes. There's a heat. And it's got some paradoxical qualities to it. It's not a pure kind of heat. There's all sorts of mixtures in it, like the batter. Anything else, buddy? Laughter. There's a genuine sense of, it's not a surface mirth. There's something kind of deep body, and we recognize a lot here. We're recognizing, I think, some very deep soul thing. We're recognizing our families, and we're recognizing much more than that. We're recognizing the pathos of our human condition, I think, in this.
It feels like we've
had
it on the back
there. Yeah. It's filled with the mercy of the self, I think. I kind of use that language. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But you feel the mercy of deeper elements here that can kind of contain and hold and put us in a vessel that cooks us. There is judgment in these images. There's grace, but there's mercy. Oh, yes, the great goddess is here. Sophia is here in a Gnostic sense. Sophia, who, you know, out of love, she broke the rules and fell and then kind of goofed up, and it's kind of hung, the Valentinian Gnostic. See, she's hung at about the 32nd level. You know, the elevator went down, you know, and she stopped it when she realized what happened, about the 32nd level. But she cares so much. She's above us. She's there. She feels with us. Sophia, through every one of these images, she feels our plight on the Rio Grande, on the border between the unconscious and the conscious, and between the have-nots and the haves, between the past and the future. She's there with us. Feels our anguish. Uh-huh. Yeah. There is a true... So we're getting into themes. There's a true image of true and false love here. There's an image of the true possible conjunctio. You know, Jung talks about the theos gamos between the masks. It's not only an outer marriage, but much more important, and you'll see this film gets even more, the metaphors get even more overt, it's about the inner marriage of soul. There's two films in the last 5 years that have had a wonderful alchemical transformation or apotheosis of the feminine, experiencing the conjunction of all the opposites. Aliens 3 has it, surprisingly. For those of you, it's an incredible consummative theme. And this film has a wonderful image of the coming together, the merger of the opposites in a dark and broken world that make light. You actually see, I won't tell you more, but you will see, the Gnostics talk about the lost splinters of God's light, even in this dark fallen world. You see all the lost sparks being gathered up, finding the one true inner experience of the soul. What other themes did you see here? You know, we're kind of talking about themes. Where is Eros? Where are symbols of Eros? I said this shows Eros. Where are symbols of Eros? The food. I mean, the very base thing about how flat our food is. This food is erotic food all the way through. This film, and Eros is just not joy. It's greed. It's the deep and trueness of any genuine passion. And her tears fall in the great vase, the batter, and we feel true grief with her. So yes, the Eros falls in the food. Where else does the Eros fall out? In Nacha, yes, Nacha carries true air. Kind of this true ancestral. She's not just our grandmother. She's all the deep, wise ancestors we all know were there. That we kind of missed in our worldly ancestors sometimes. But we know when they die, they're going to get it all kind of done. And they're pulling for us in some kind of realm. As awful as it felt like in this world sometimes, we all have a Nacha. It kind of brings up the Nacha archetype in all of us. The Eros of the ancestors. Which is one of the three places, you know, Sardello says one of the three places, the corrective places to find Eros and repair the damage. The first place you go is you must get erotically reconnected with the ancestors. Sardello says it's a primary way to recover Eros in a lost culture. In a Jungian and Greek sense, it's through the ancestors. It is the ancestors. that bring us Eros first. And this film dramatically gets us, we've got multi-generations here. And even the demiurge mother, all of our experiences, the fallen parts of our mothers and fathers. They kind of look like false gods at times. But they, somehow that ancestral presence moves. So the Eros is in the food, it's in the ancestors. Where else is the Eros? The healing Eros. Is, the director feels it so much and says we can find it. Where else is there Eros? Oh, what incredible body Eros, those legs. But it's but he look, they are so many. I mean, he goes beyond the limit in a way filled with mercy, just in those legs. There's so much more Eros there than all that kind of breasts and penises running around in the previous scene. I mean, just the legs and the apples. I mean, talk about a garden of Eden, the apples. Oh, did I hurt you, jerk? You know, I mean. Oh, are you looking at my legs? I mean, it's a wonderful play with that image. But it's a wonderful encounter. There are two encounters there. A genuine encounter of both judgment. There's judgment there. And there's grace in the meeting of the masculine and feminine two times. That hoped-for conjunction we all want. We never can hold it in this world, but we've all had moments, hopefully all of us have, where we've seen that, and we treasure those. I still remember the first 30 seconds I met my wife. I have a Gibson's 30-second rule. I do a lot of marriage and family therapy. I remember the first 30 seconds I met my wife by a Coke machine in the basement of the administrative hall at graduate school. And that moment was one of my Eros moments. It's most treasured. When I have couples that are damaged, and we all are damaged, I really want to hear the first 30 seconds of when they met. The unconscious psyche, the erotic psyche, just it's like two DNA strands meet and they put it all together. All of the crazy stuff and the yearning stuff all get locked in the first 30 seconds. I'm absolutely convinced of that. It happens that rapidly when we meet the profound other in the inner and the outer world. Then we spend a lifetime suffering out what got kind of cut there. Spend a lifetime suffering. The consequences are enormous for those meetings, as they are for Tita and Pablo. They're enormous, but they're there. So in the meeting, where else was an image? Oh, the house is a wonderful house. The house is alive. The house the psyche built. Kate and I have been hearing from one of our colleagues. Russ has been introducing us to Mitha Trophonius and the house of good fortune. Well, this feels like the house of good fortune. It's all there. It's crazy. I mean, houses of good fortune. Don't keep the craziness away. But it's a great house. Eros is in the house itself. And in the land. The land itself is a river. The river. I live on a river. Rivers are wonderfully erotic things. Gonna have to give up the river for the lodge. I mean, it's a river for the temple. But rivers carry Eros. And the community, communitas itself, it is all humanity. It is the wedding. The Gnostics say the highest rite in the Gnostic canon is being revived now. What we can gather, we've heard about it now with the Nag Hammadi. You know, it's amazing that within 18 months we're developing the capacity to incinerate the world. Stefan Holler, in a couple of books out there, suggests this openly. Isn't it interesting? Within 18 months after Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the fire, the worst fire of the false gods gets out of the box. The worst part of our destructiveness and darkness that may choke us forever and kill all of the last lights, the final light that turns everything into darkness. Within 18 months, the earth coughs up the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi documents. 52 lost codexes where the Gnostics no longer speak through an angry Irenaeus or Hippolytus or people that hated them, but speak for themselves directly through the gospel of truth and the gospel of Philip and the gospel of Thomas. We got it all. We don't have all the lost literature. We got them in their own tongue now. And it's an incredibly Eros-rich kind of literature that speaks of the Eros of community. And the highest rite there is the wedding banquet. You know, it's this kind of thing where it's the inner wedding of the inner masculine. June talked about wonderfully in her book about it's the conjunction of the inner masculine, the outer masculine, inner and outer masculines happening together in feminines, inside the soul and outside. Well, the wedding feast is here. It's a false one still, but it's honest. It's not completely false. And it prefigures the true wedding feast. This is a Gnostic event happening here. And the mediation is all community. The saints, the sinners, the rapists, the lovers, they're all there around that table. It's all our families. It's a family. It's a family of man and woman around the table. They're all there. And they're all eating food together. And they're all grieving together. A great mood of melancholic, of erotic melancholy and yearning for the deeper true self comes out. This is real eroticness. You could contrast the lack of Eros in the rapture with the abundance of eros here in like water for chocolate. Let's take about a 5-minute. Imagine your bladders are over and over. Substance of the land. And how to vomit up all of the bad, interjected, negative experience we've had of our innocence being violated that gets in the way of getting at the true splinters of light that's in our soul substance. Another ways that you can think about this. Frames of erotic suffering. And this eros, what it does best is it births in us compassion. The ability not to be afraid of our own sorrow and loss, but to be able to stand with others. Compassion literally means the ability to co-suffer with other human beings. The rapture shows you this woman's capacity to stand by and not only start to have compassion for her own suffering, but to co-suffer with other people. That's how she becomes Job. And eventually she even has the guts to stand up and co-suffer with God and God's shadow. That's why everybody was so upset with Jung in the 50s. Jung always said, "I'm no theologian." Bullhunky. I mean, Jung wrote the most provocative piece of theology in the 20th century in answer to Job. It upset Roman Catholic. He was non-discriminate in the Roman Catholic and Protestant theologians he upset and Jewish theologians. They all were universally upset nearly. Because he was basically saying God needs us as much as we need God. That God is yearning and emptiness and love. I mean, it's a provocative text. And Jung says, "Oh, I'm just talking about psychology. I'm not alluding to anything beyond, again, Bullhunky." I mean, it's a profound text. But eros teaches us best to compassion suffering. And how to do that? It provides a frame of meaningful engagement with our mortality and immortality. Life and death issues. And you can feel them in the passage of the generations. I mean, death is here. The death of the old and the birth of the new. A frame that values the experiential over the factual. The key Gnostic thing that I think upset the institutional church and why they were destroyed. They were hunted down. They were killed. Their libraries were burnt. Nagabani only survived because it was way up the Nile River in a backwater. And the monks saw the purging Christians coming and got the stuff buried in jars out behind. We don't know how much was buried there. You know, the story was that it was an Arab found it. And he was hiding out because he'd killed somebody in another family and avoiding a feud warfare. And he's hiding because he would have gotten killed himself. And he thought it was safe to come back. He brought all the stuff he found in these jars. And his mother used it for kindling to light a fire. We don't know how much of it got burnt. Vast amount of this literature is up in those Coptic jars, got burned to make simple meals. Maybe it should have been, but at least some of it survived. But you need to know these people were hunted down, and a key thing was they believed, above all else, that Scripture happens every night, that the divine talks to each of us through every waking moment and dream. The experiential is much more valuable than the dogmatic. And for that, they were hunted down and cursed more than anything else. That's the Jungian heresy today. Is that you all carry the vessels of light and need to be responsible for, and don't let anybody's dogma get in the way of your own experience. Not even your analyst. You know, you've got to deify this stuff sometimes. You are responsible for the erotic management of your own divinity. Let no one else take that responsibility and suffering away from you. Primary Gnostic tenet. Of course, they had a few other minor things that up people, like they didn't like structure, and they saw women as equal with men in the centrist communities. And those kind of things upset the boys in Rome and Alexandria and Cairo, Jerusalem. A frame that values the relational over the theoretical. A frame that values the imaginal over the conceptual. The image is much more important. I was with a Quaker a couple nights ago. Parker Palmer, so he writes wonderfully. He's a Quaker and he writes a lot of spiritual stuff. He's down at UPS for 3 days. And he says, out of the Quaker tradition, they say, they love silence. Don't speak unless you can improve upon the silence. It's a wonderful kind of thing. Well, don't speak unless you can improve upon the silence. A great Quaker adage. And on that, I want to say, don't speak unless you can improve upon the image. We're an imaginal people. And a frame that values the spiritual over the material world. Doesn't discount us, but it inverts the value that our world puts on things. So, I'll show you one last thing, and we'll close with an image that I think celebrates all of this in a least expected place by the people that brought you Miami Vice. Somebody's asking about TV. Michael Mann and Associates. You know, what good can come from Nazareth? What good can come from Michael Mann and Associates or Miami Vice? Major tenets of a contemporary Gnosticism mediated by the cinema. And all of that I've been seeing, we'll have a closing experience of that. The Gnostic path avowed here is the non-dualist Gnostic tradition. Now, there were dualist, and there were crazy Gnostic traditions. I mean, I've written about this, some bizarre, like the Sophia Barbello cults in Alexandria that
So you wonder. I mean, the kind of people that ended up doing bizarre things like Tom, you know, Jonestown in Switzerland, it's always been with us. It's nothing new. But somebody got the bizarre idea that in the middle of a worship service, you literally milk menstrual fluids from women and semen from men, and you mix it in Eucharist blood, and you take it, and it's some kind of divine union feast. Now, that's a crazy, dualist, bizarre idea. And there was that all kinds of... I just give you as an example of the kind of crazy... So when you hear people say, there were crazy... What? There are crazy Roman Catholics and crazy Protestants. There's those things that all our traditions get crazy when they get rigid and they get bizarre and they don't get checked by a breathing eros. But the best of these traditions, the traditions that Reverend Sophia and her fall to find, and her weeping in the vessel of life with us, getting us to vomit up our negative introjects of a dark world to find the real life that's still in our belly, was a non-dualist tradition that was not at all interested in separating mind and body or male and female or heaven and earth, but was interested in finding their conjunction. The divine wedding feast was always the goal. And that's the tradition I want to talk about that I think is central in film. Experience exceeds scripture as a source of information about the divine. Individuation gradually transforms us into beings who are more and more strangers to our surrounding world milieu. It makes us more and more alien to our time and its lostness. I mean, I had those experiences a lot in my lifetime. You know, I was thinking about the difference of our invasion of Haiti, but I remember the night that we invaded. The first time I've seen us go to war overnight, I went through Vietnam, but we kind of just drifted into that darkness. But the Persian Gulf War, and my horror and how alien I felt from it. The whole culture was whipped up. My wife and I were afraid to talk publicly about our feelings about it. You all remember? I mean, I felt like we were talking about moving to New Zealand. It got so crazy overnight. And in 30 days, you know, statistics I'm reading, they still have not released this, but in 30 days, we killed over 200,000 people. That's probably more mass loss of life in a shorter period of time than about any other time in the history of the world. We killed 500,000 in our civil war, but that took we took 5 years to do that face-to-face. They were killed by horrible gas bombs in these trenches. I don't know if you knew it, what they dropped on were these gas bombs that burned and eviscerated, sucked the oxygen out of the lungs and then burned their bodies up. I mean, it was a... And they got in and buried all those trenches. But I'm hearing the statistics are much higher than would have been released. Well, I felt like an alien during the whole 30 days and still recovering. The Gnostics say the world gets so dark, we get so afraid of the erotic truth that's possible. And if you hold on to the soul, you often feel like an alien in a world that's... the world looks more like the rapture world than this deep. History and future are by and large regressive illusions. We're always, you know, everybody's saying... Well, you got to feel guilty about what's happening in the past or feel anxious about what's happening in the future. That's why people come to therapy. They're preoccupied with guilt about the past or anxiety about the future. Chronos is sitting there eating these babies again. Chronological time. There's no divine time. People are. The Gnostics say if you get taught with history and the future, what you have to remember is the divine and her sorrowful, conscious wholeness are realizable in the compassionate now. She's in the room tonight. She's in the room and we're all moved by these images and can feel safe sharing, being touched about Tita and Nacha. The universalization of the one, we are all part of a one spiritual wholeness that regardless of traditions, the Gnostic, I think they would say with us, whether you're Lakota Sioux or Buddhist or Sufi or Christian or Jungian or whatever sect you're a part of, we're all part of one common, palpable, spiritual, merciful, graceful, whole. That's their affirmation of faith. And she's realizable in this wedding banquet. The feminine is the most, and in our culture particularly, the feminine is the most precious vessel and a container of the divine hyper-God. Women are co-equal to men organizationally, vocationally, liturgically, and existentially. The core non-dualist Gnostic communities affirm that, ordained, co-ordained women, and valued their co-presence before the mysteries of the world. So closing image. Again, it's a Michael Mann, a macho director, a favorite tale, James Fenimore Cooper, The Last of the Mohegans. You all thought, well, this is a wonderful scene. You know, our hero, Chinggis Shook, and it was grandly filmed, by the way. It's a surprisingly touching film. And you've read the story, but here it is. Our men of the woods have found our fair damsels in distress who are in the charge of this kind of rigid British soldier. And they're in the midst of fire between French and Indian wars, British and... Got some their tribes allied with them, and the French got their tribes. And these are homesteaders and hunters in the midst. And she's a royal person from Boston coming out, and she's going into the wilderness. Because clearly, you see, it's a metaphor for the unconscious. And she is Sophia again, and it is the anima lost, the feminine. And where the scene opens, he's trying to take her back to her father in the fort. And they're getting very quiet because the French and their allies are looking for them in the dark. And the place they hid is the place that the Native Americans they've co-allied with respect the burial ground. So they've hidden right under the burial ground, being safe there in the night. And you see a dialogue happening between the two of them. And you think, my gosh, this guy did... These are the same people that did Miami Vice. The land, the archetypal world, the midst people thought they were just getting an entertainment on Sunday night. And she says to the audience, "You're right, we do not understand what is happening here." A couple closing images. First, let's let the Gnostics speak for themselves, and then I'd be happy to bring the end of the evening to a close. And out of June's book, she does a nice thing. I like to Xerox her things because if you do them out of the Nag Hammadi Library, they've had brackets where words are missing or translations are uncertain, and she's done a nice job of giving flowing translations from the Apocrypha of John. She's labeled, this is her label, it's nice, the womb of everything. The invisible spirit looks at himself in the light that surrounds him, the water of life. He gives to every realm in every way, putting his desire into the spring of the pure light water. His thought performed a deed, and she came forth. She appeared before him in the radiance of his light. Her light shines like his light, the perfect power of the virginal spring. She is the first power to come forth from his mind. She is the forethought of the all. She became the womb of everything, for she is prior to them all. The mother, father, the first man, the Holy Spirit, and the eternal realm among the invisible realms. He looked at her with the pure light, and she conceived from him. He begot a spark of light and anointed it until it became perfect with the goodness of the Spirit. When it had received from the Spirit, it glorified the Spirit and the perfect forethought for whose sake it had come forth. Apocrypha of John. And a Gnostic mentor of mine, this is telling Paul earlier that 20 years ago, I think I primarily got interested in Gnostics. I've always been a Gnostic, I think. As I now feel the alien, I can remember when I was a kid, some of my earliest memories was loving my grandfather's and grandmother's farm. When I first got conscious enough, my parents would put me on a train when I was a big boy, like 6 or 7. I could go down there alone. And they had me down there all alone. I was the only grandson out of about 9 granddaughters at that point. And I'd farm with my granddad for 2, 3, 4 weeks of summer. And I'd get in their bed right between their bodies in that 100-year-old farmstead at night. And they both snored, you know, and it'd be that... I could smell the bed. I'd be this little kid snuggling right between them. And I just... on the sea of the ancestors. The North Star you could see through this old 100-year-old homesteader rippled glass window. My Kansas farm. And I'd smell her body odors, the goodness of the earth around here, the night sounds of the animals, the cows mewing, getting up in the morning. And I had my own little kid, after this, like my granddad. He had a boot, big boot. I had a little boot just like his from the same old store. And another boot. And he had his bibbers, and he'd put them on a leg at a time. I put my bibbers. And he had big egg pails, and I had little egg pails. He got me my own little kit. So it's a kind of ancestral thing. But sometimes I'd go alone, and I'd hear the wind in the electric wires, like the rural electrification program, and the moaning of the wind, and the melancholy used to make me cry. I think even at that early age, I felt alien. I felt called to something more, but I felt an alienness in this world. Kind of melancholy. And when I went to seminary, I learned some people knew about this. It's really interesting. I went to the most liberal seminary in the country last day. They called it the Pink Fringe Seminary at Boston University, where a lot of the kind of communist Methodists came from. My parents were radically upset. It was one of the reasons I went. But all the Gnostic books, is like when you were a kid, the dirty stuff you had to be old enough to get from behind the counter at the public library. All the Gnostic stuff was behind the counter. And I started reading some of this stuff. But one of my mentors, there was a guy named Harold Beck, was one of the most... He was an Arabic scholar, spoke about 6 languages, married an Egyptian Copt woman. It was just wonderful. He was the first man I met that loved me with pure father eros as an adult. And he saw something in me. He cared. Who knows why he chose to be a mentor? You know, why we mentor people we mentor. But he loved me at a very vulnerable time in my life. I could have fallen forever. And he mediated Sophia for me, I think. A wonderful man. Kind of man they always put in these giant lecture halls. And the lecture would start to be like 30 of us enrolled, and there'd be 200 seats around. You know, what is this? And by the fifth or sixth week, the place was packed. Because this guy, the non-matriculating people come in and just sit and listen to this guy's lecture. He always had a prepared lecture. He'd come in, and after about the first 5 minutes, he says, "Do you mind if I go off on a tangent?" he would see my wife and I out here. We'd been here 17 years on his way to Hong Kong to teach or stuff. He was a kind of man as well-known as he was and as loved.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.